Welcome to the Gold Digger podcast series, a series that investigates the mysterious decline of Australian rugby union. It's a fan's journey into the void to pick up the pieces of Australian rugby union and find a path forward to fortune and glory. I'm your host and humble rugby servant, Matt Darren. And this is episode 21. Yes, it's been a bit of time between innings. I do apologise, as always. Life is getting in the way, but I'm committed to continually putting out more episodes, and there is a lot more to come. The film is oh so close to being finished, and I'm looking forward to be able to make some announcements about that soon. But for now, I'm continuing on with the theme of looking at New South Wales and Sydney rugby. In our last episode, we spoke to Adam from the Penrith Junior, or formerly involved in the Penrith RSL Junior Club. And it's got some really interesting responses from people. A lot of people responded to that. I think a lot of people have opinions about what's happening at club level, in club land, certainly in Western Sydney. And so it's good that that conversation is happening. Nothing has been confirmed yet for what the Shoot Shield competition will look like in 2022, but obviously that is still being negotiated and discussed by the clubs. So continuing in that theme, I thought I'd speak to someone who is from another club that has perhaps a different story. And I was put in touch with Peter Sherwood, who's a life member of Gordon Rugby Club in North Sydney. And he's a person who's been very instrumental in helping Gordon turn itself around financially, from a governance perspective, and certainly on-field performance-wise, as they are the reigning Shoot Shield premiers. But in the last two decades, it's been a very different story for Gordon. And so it is a bit of a comeback story. I spoke to him just this last week about his involvement in the club and the wider context of Sydney Club Rugby. You know, we touch on the way that the clubs are continually having to restructure in Australia, and that ever so blurred line between the amateur and professional streams. And we spoke just last weekend after Sydney had been placed on lockdown and all local rugby was cancelled. So Peter was very able to be generous with his time to chat. And it's an interesting story about how the Gordon Highlanders came back to be a powerhouse of Sydney Club Rugby. Peter, thanks very much for joining me.
Pleasure, Matt. Absolute pleasure. And, you know, I hope that I can be of help to you and your audience.
Yeah, well, look, I'd love to know, firstly, I guess your background in rugby. Obviously, you've been involved in Gordon Rugby Club for a long time. But sort of how did you first get into the sport?
It's just a normal way. I'm actually a Norse junior who came through like North Sydney Demonstration School, played in the, you know, sort of sevens, eights and all that sort of thing, and the reps, and then actually went over to play with Lane Cove, which happened to be in the Gordon Juniors, because mates at high school, I went to North Sydney Tech and then North Sydney High, were playing with Lane Cove. And it's funny, I actually went to see Gordon play Randwick at Chatswood Oval in 1967, when there was close to 10,000 people at Chatswood Oval.
Wow.
And Gordon, this was the year that Gordon, the prior year were Wooden Spooners, and Randwick had 12 or 13 Wallabies in their side. And I went there and I was just, you know, as a young kid, I was, 67, so I was 13, and I just saw this brand of rugby that captured my imagination and the Gordon spirit. And I went and played in Lane Cove Juniors, then the rep sides and Colts, and went to grade in the early 70s. Had to give grade away because of work, because at that stage I got married and needed to work and what have you. And I wasn't able to participate a lot in rugby until my son started playing in the Warringah Juniors for DY Lions. And so I got involved with DY Lions, and I didn't want to ever be one of those fathers on the sideline that, you know, having been a past player, would So I got into the administration side. If I could do something to help club, I would, and I enjoyed doing that. Got involved with Warringah through that. Then in about 2010, I went to a 75th, what was billed as a 75th anniversary of the Gordon Rugby Club as a bit of a reunion, but it turned out being a tribute to Stirling Mortlock.
Mm.
And as a result of that, the journey to start with Gordon, a return to Gordon began. And it's one of those interesting stories where I was invited along by one of the sponsors, and he just said to me, "I'm a bit concerned about Gordon's financial position. They seem to be asking me for advances on my sponsorship. Would you mind getting in and helping out?" And I said, "Well, you know," I said, "yes." And that's where we went.
Yeah.
And you know, here we are 10 years later, Gordon, the Schuylkill Premiers, and have done a remarkable building job just through a lot of hard work and understanding where the problems were and taking ownership of those problems.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, and you know, in as much detail as you're allowed to go into, what were the sort of current woes that the club was in? Because it sort of went, certainly when I look at Gordon as a club historically, it's always been very strong. It's had minor premierships, it's had premierships. I was sort of looking back at the Schuylkill Premiership history. And in the 50s, it seems that Gordon was pretty much one of the stronger clubs. You know, they were sort of, if not in the final, they were winning it. I don't know what, if you can recall, and that's before your time, what you'd attribute success to.
You know, I've become a bit of a historian just by stumbling along. And
well, you're on the right podcast, Peter. So this is all about rugby history.
It's quite an amazing thing because, you know, Gordon were the Roseville Rugby Club, and in 1936 they joined the Schuylkill or First Division Rugby at the time.
Yep.
And you know, they were always rivals with Norths, and you know, it goes back to the 36 where a number of players moved from Norths who were very strong at that time to play for Gordon. And really, because Gordon was on a railway line at Chatswood Oval, it made it a lot easier for people to get to training, whereas North were still training. I think they were training North in the Oval or Primrose, somewhere around that. But the deal was that North supported them on the basis that Gordon would move further up the line at some stage in the future and really become Gordon as they were, or as they were meant to be. And of course, that didn't happen. It's been a sore point between the two clubs. It really sort of encourages the rivalry. But yeah. Gordon, as we know it today, and as the Highlanders came into being in about 1947-48, when Trevor Allen's father, Slab Allen, came to the club and said, "Hey guys, do you really want to be just middle of the table footballers, or do you want to be a, you know, a dominant force?" And he changed the colours from the Roseville Reds and Blues into the current tartan. He encouraged having the club song, because he always believed that singing was part of bonding. It was part of generating enthusiasm, motivation, and was sending a message to the opposition that no matter whether you won or you lost, you were never beaten. Mm. You were proud of who you were. And the colours became the yellow, green, blue and black were really a statement, because most other clubs just had two colour jerseys. So this was a bright statement of intent to play attractive rugby. He then built sides around. He had some of the great hard men of Sydney, rugby, Ken Yance, Snowy Norton, Bomber Miles, who came in, and he built a side that won four premierships. Bob Davidson, Wallaby captain, won four premierships between 1949 and 1959. And the two other strong clubs at the time were Manly and St George, funnily enough. St George were one of their great rivals. Sydney Uni, Norths were there, but there was really a St Gordon, St George, Manly decade, as I understand it. And then through the 60s, Gordon sort of tapered off and hit a low point in 66 where they won the wooden spoon. 67 came along, and they were just a talented side of youngsters. You'd call them like Rod Batterham, Rex Batterham, Warwick Moss, John Sheeran, who I still see today. And John, if to just sidetrack, goal-kicking front rower, scored over 200 points as a prop, wow, including seven tries. Bruce Tafe was his hooker, the Wallaby hooker. They were just a marvellous side. Warwick Allen, Huey Trollope, and they were captained by David Shepherd, who was at that stage, I think, a 31-year-old Wallaby who came from Victoria. So they had you had a blend of youth with a very with a senior, you know, leader.
Great. And they went from wooden spoon to minor premiers in one season.
No, they were they went to the grand finalists, and they played the Randwick side.
Yeah.
That was chock-a-block full of Wallabies and got beaten.
1916 in the grand final. Looking at the score now.
And if you have a look at the YouTube of that, they say that one of the most brilliant tries by Ken Catchpole was the deciding factor.
Right.
And so from 67 to 69, they were in grand finals against Easts. 72, we had all sides in the grand final and won the club championship, only to lose to Sydney Uni in the grand final. And Sydney Uni had that, they were the time when they had that wonderful group of players coming through, ended up being Wallabies. 76, Gordon won first grade and second grade. And then we went into some lean periods where we were there or thereabouts. Then again in the 90s, 93, 95, 98, premierships. Yeah. You know, captained by Mark Hartill, wonderful Timmy Wallace, Mitch Hardy, Phil Scar, Brett O'Neill, just a wonderful group of players, and Mike Spaulding and so forth. And then we hit the lean years again until last year when I think it was after 22 years won the Shoot Shield again. Yeah. But we were always strong in lower grades in those tough years. So I think between Norths and Gordon, we probably had the two most successful clubs in third and fourth grade. But it didn't sort of translate through into the latter years.
So what's your sort of overall, looking back, and obviously you're probably trying to now ensure that the club doesn't sort of, have a kind of a lean period, but looking back, what are the areas you think needed to be addressed to sort of get the club to be successful at the top grade, but also I suppose as the club to be healthy?
Well, I think it's actually an interesting question because when I played and through those period, there was the residential rule. So if you lived in a particular area, you had to play for that particular club, except for Sydney University, which I think you could play with Sydney Uni until 2 years after you graduated, something like that. So you had strength in Western Suburbs, Des Moines, Gordon, Norths, because of where you lived. I think the professional era changed that, and the moving away from the residential rules, so people were free to join clubs. And so as when the professional era hit, people were moving jobs for opportunity. Were moving clubs for opportunity as much as they were for work and getting a little bit on the petrol money or what have you. And I think over time you would say, and this is my perception is club loyalty became less important as it became a way of perhaps supplementing an income or at least earning something in for your endeavors. And I think that's the genesis of, a lot of the things. So then you also had and I give a lot of credit to Sydney Uni. I know a lot of people have the view of Sydney Uni, and love them or hate them, you have to admire them, because when they hit second division, and Nick Farr-Jones always said to me, when we became the basket case, they built a model. You know, the Friends of Sydney Uni with Bonawenabon, that whole support mechanism was supported, and they built up the foundation and they provided a pathway and a whole lot of things. And they created something that was beyond just playing rugby for your club. They provided opportunity. But I actually admired that. So part of the journey with Gordon was to look at Sydney Uni's model. You know, Gordon, probably a bit of fast forward along to where Gordon was in 2010, 2011, they were probably paying, for players probably more than they could afford, because they had a licensed club and a rugby club, and it's that era where rugby clubs shouldn't be running licensed clubs; they're different beasts, the different skill sets, all those sorts of things. And over the years, you've seen rugby clubs losing their licensed club affiliations or their ownerships for that very reason, I think. They were paying professional or semi-professional coaches were coming along, and they were, people wanted success. The only way to get success was to buy in players. So question mark was, were you buying in players prudently? The old question, were you buying a premiership? It didn't make sense. And so whether the decision was right or wrong, in Gordon's case, they were spending more than they were able to fund. So you'd have to say that they were technically in a position of insolvency. They weren't breaking, they were just spending beyond their means. And that said to me that, this was an unsustainable model and we needed to do something about it. Then you had the other thing, you've got the biggest junior base in Sydney rugby, with the private school base. There was always the question, why were they going to other clubs, especially Sydney Uni? And there was always the poaching, or if that's the right word. I understand the argument. I'm not quite sure I buy that argument. All I support or buy is that Sydney Uni had a model, and if I was going to Sydney Uni and I had the ability to go from lectures to training to the facilities that they have, why wouldn't I? Why go home and all that sort of thing? Whether they were offering scholarships or what have you, that's another story, but I admire them for what they did. So we said we need to build a program. Andrew Winterbaum was absolutely 100% supportive, as was David Begg, who was president of Manly at the time, and a number of other people that we went to see and say, here's our problem. How would you suggest we go about it? Why has it been successful for you? And so we broke it all down and said, okay, that's our model. That's best in class. Let's get there. So we said we need a scholarship program, and we were very fortunate to have a good partner in UTS, and a guy called David Hale, Dr. David Hale, who is a member of the Friends of Sydney Uni, helped me with the introduction to UTS, and we went to see Liz Morgan-Brett and her team and said, look, we're at the bottom of the table. We're not traveling well, but we believe that with the right support and being able to attract the right sort of players that would be cognizant and consistent with your ideals for sporting scholarships, we can make a partnership work. And they were very supportive with us, and they've been terrific partners since, I think, 2012 to 2021. We then went to a medical program. This is going to be sound like it's Sydney Uni, but there was I'm going to forget his surname, but he was a dentist up at Dimble, and his son was heavily in. He played for Sydney Uni. His son played for Sydney Uni, And he said, look, you know, we need to, a dental program is always helpful, mouth guards, this type of thing. Okay, that was another piece of the pie. We then also had to look at how do we have a support base like a friends of. So we started the Friends of Gordon, which we really modelled on the Friends of Warringah, who started the year before. Brendan Patterson, John Heffernan, and Steve Doyle, Steve Crawford, who were terrific servants of Warringah Rugby. And so I got together with a couple of other friends about Paul. We ended up in the first year with over 100 ex-Gordon players who had been, they drifted off doing their thing. But when we said there was a call to arms to get together, they all sort of said, we're in, you know, we'll come in and support and do, what can we do?
Yeah.
And on that basis, we were then able to, you know, sort of move forward. And then towards the latter part of it, it took really a thumping from Norths in about 2018. I think Norths beat Gordon 96-24, the most humbling experience in the club's history. Matt Glascott has been moved up to president and said, it ain't going to happen on my watch again. And he brought in Darren Coleman, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
So I think what we had was, if you look at it in just piecemeal, it is, there was a group of guys like myself who got involved and built business plans. Because we have business backgrounds, and not look at necessarily player, but structures and so forth. Put those in place, put governance in place, put proper mechanisms in place to ensure that you didn't leak money, you actually built money, if that makes sense. So that the real people who understand the rugby side of it can then go the next step.
Yeah.
The foundations are very important.
Yeah, I mean, and it's really interesting hearing you sort of lay it out like that, because obviously people might say, well, yes, you've just kind of replicated what Sydney Uni done, but no, actually you've looked at what works in other, you know, Warringah, Sydney Uni, and then sort of like it's a bespoke fit to what when works in Gordon. And I think you know, it's a unique part of Sydney. If people who aren't from Sydney are listening, you know, it is sort of it's north of the bridge. There's a real mix. Obviously you've got the private schools in that area, but then you've also got a sort of a middle class around that, and it connects to the sort of the hills and all the, you know, it's funny, Gordon. I've always thought when I moved to Sydney and started playing rugby, it was in an interesting spot, because it wasn't quite Manly, it wasn't quite just the North Shore, it wasn't quite the hills.
Yep.
It's sort of a great little center point to all these different parts of Sydney. And I mean, you know, I was at Sydney University in 2004, 2005. So I was there when Sydney Uni were ramping up their system. And I can tell you that there was the groups of guys that seemed to be the cream of the crop from the private schools that were there either studying or there on scholarships. But then there was in the lower grades, guys from Western Sydney, guys from probably other parts of the East. You know, there were even, I remember actually there being a couple of Randwick guys that were there. And it did seem to then attract people because of what was happening at the club. I think there was this perception that there was success if you're at Sydney University. And I think once a club becomes successful, it then just starts to attract a second group of people that go there because they think it's going to better fit them individually.
I totally. I think there's we took the view. So we spoke to Warringah about things. We spoke to Norths. We spoke to Randwick was interesting. We spoke to a few people there. You know, rugby, the community helps each other. Now, we're independent of which side of what club we go to. Brent Papworth was helpful to us. And, you know, all these rivalries that you have on the field, the one thing that brings them everybody together is the fact that they want to have the ongoing rivalries and competitiveness and the whole rugby piece. And they're willing, very willing to help. And so you look at, and this is the way I kind of looked at it with a group of people. And I had some brilliant people guys like Graham Hurl, who's, and Peter Hurl, the Hurl brothers are synonymous with Gordon Rugby. Their father, Bill Hurl, is a life member. Will Jeffcott, who was a terrific centre, and he was chairman of the Waratahs at one point. He's been a great Gordon club. I couldn't tell you the number. Ivo Clark, Al Kirkby. We have people that have played a lot of their rugby. Their kids have come through juniors. They came through juniors, and they're just Gordon people. And they said, and they were. We had we banded together as a sort of a group of ex guys and said, what can we do? What do we need to do to make sure that Gordon is not only a successful club again, but a sustainable, successful club? Because players will come and go. It always fascinates me that, I don't know if this number's right, but it's a perceptual number. Probably 20% of juniors come through from playing junior rugby into Colts, and probably 5-10% actually go through into first grade. Because once you get through your university or your tertiary or your apprenticeships or whatever, life takes different turns for you.
Yeah.
So we sort of believe that you have to provide a pathway of not only the rugby pathway, but the development pathway. So that, because, you know, we guys like myself, 50 years later, are still involved. So you've got the camaraderie, but you've got the life things, you've got everything that goes into it. It's a community. And that's how you survive and thrive, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, look, I want to look more broadly then at the club scene in Sydney, and obviously one of the pressing topics at the moment is Sydney Rugby Union and looking at the way they're drafting a new participation agreement for 2022, and you know there's a massive. A lot of perceptions going all over the place. I had someone from Penrith, from a Penrith junior club on the podcast last time, just talking about the challenges they're facing in Western Sydney. And I think their challenges are not unlike many other people's challenges. The difference being is they are really on the battle lines between the codes. And, I think it's all kind of quite well documented. But Gordon is one of the clubs that has been accused is the word, but certainly fingers have been pointed of colluding with some of the other clubs to put together these participation agreements that are going to make it very difficult for Penrith and probably even Two Blues to meet those requirements. So, were you able to kind of give me any more background onto the history of how this has come about and what actually the clubs that are all part of the Sydney Rugby Union are trying to achieve in drafting these things and making, obviously trying to improve the quality of the competition?
Probably not close enough to it. I can go back to about, say, 2012. There was a participation agreement that the clubs had to sign, which had... In basically, you had to be able to field four sides, three cult sides, and through that participation agreement there was a grant that the ARU at the time would pay back to the clubs, which was for the administration, was to help with the administration development through the clubs. I think it was 2013. Randwick, Gordon, and Penrith were not paid 30% of that or something because we did not meet the requirements in their assessment of that. You had to have medical staff, full-time medical doctor, all this type of thing. And what they were doing was saying, you've got to have a sustainable model. Now, at that time, Gordon had one cult side. We'd forfeited fourth grade in the first fourth grade match of the year. We were struggling. And I think this would be, again, anecdotally, I think what they've come to say is that if we want to have a strong and competitive rugby environment, then we have to be able to reach this level. I don't know there'd be anything nefarious about it or in link, because everybody wants to see a strong Parramatta, a strong, you know, a strong Penrith, and a strong West Harbour. I went to watch Penrith and play Warringah a couple of weeks ago, and they had a red hot crack. Penrith with their one side and their one Colt side, they had a red hot crack. It was 15-3 at half time, and I thought, this is great. This is great. Imagine if they could build upon that.
Yeah.
So, I personally, I don't subscribe to the collusion. I can understand how people would form a view, but I think the broader view is, what is it going to take to get those clubs into a position where they can meet the requirement? Because there's no point in playing, you know, do you have a fourth grade? Some clubs think, yes, no, let's do away with fourth grade. My view is, fourth grade is the foundation of your club system. It kicks off your day, you know.
Yeah.
It provides you a grade. Third and fourth grade provide you with a grade where players who might only be able to train twice a week and still be part of your club, be available when the injuries come. But if they kick your day off, they're still there at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. You know what I mean? That's the way it seems to be. But the question, I think, is how big is the pool to be able to sustain whatever model the Sydney Rugby believes is right?
Yeah.
And, you know, you look back and you look at state championships, and Penrith were the winningest club in this junior state championships.
Yeah.
No club won more. They won two juniors state championships. I think one was women, one was boys. All the other clubs, you know, other clubs. So that says to me that there is an opportunity. It's how you tap the opportunity.
And I think that's probably what, you know, I mean, certainly one lesson from, you know, your recent experience with Gordon suggests is that in building a sustainable club, not just in governance, but also ensuring you retain players and create these pathways, every club is different. What works at Sydney University or what works at Randwick may not necessarily work for Two Blues. And I know certainly from listening to some of their people that have come out and spoken that I think they've tried to, say, forge a link with the University of Western Sydney. I'm talking about Two Blues.
Yep.
And unfortunately, I think when they've looked at, you know, they apparently have done surveys, the university have done surveys, rugby doesn't really rank in the top 10 of sports that most students are either aware of or interested in. So, you know, while it's sort of, it seems like an admirable way to try and engage with the university and leverage off it, that may not work in Western Sydney, and perhaps it's other sorts of areas, industries that they may have to look at tapping.
Well, maybe they're thinking about it. They should start thinking about it in reverse, not coming from it from a rugby viewpoint, but coming at it from the player that has the potential, that wants to aspire to university or with assistance would thrive in the tertiary environment or the academic environment or whatever. And rugby is actually just the assistance to help the person get there.
Mm.
What I'm trying to say in that is that in the case, university games is still a very competitive and highly sought after environment. And I think it was Greg Harris at one point when they'll put the university models of sports is still one that's highly thought of. Do you remember that they were looking at the, you know, the university games and a whole lot of, that's how the Sydney Stars sort of came in when the first year of the NRL came about. So when you look at a player, it's not that you forge a pathway with a university by you're helping to attract somebody who's going to add value to the university.
Mm.
But rugby is really, whilst it's important to the rugby club, it's actually secondary to the university of what, because the university is saying, I'm investing in that individual. What is that individual going to be able to provide me? And I don't mean that in the, you know, I mean that the asset to the university is the student.
Yeah.
The asset to the rugby club is the player. They can coexist. So how do you go about it? and how do you look at, there are a lot of kids out there who aspire to the education, who are naturally good sports people, but for whatever reason don't find the pathway, because the pathway focuses more on the sport than the development of the individual. Mm. They have to coexist, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, look, and I think that that's certainly one of the areas that of Sydney, which is changing in demographic and it's changing in what people need. I think that there are. I'm interested with your the Friends of Gordon. There's also the Gordon Rugby Foundation.
Yeah.
And both of those organisations have active roles in, say, supporting players sort of week to week, day to day in some cases. I saw one of the achievements was that you provided sort of things like rental assistance to players that were far away. These are things that you guys are constantly monitoring, and then where there's a need, you'll call upon the members or you'll try to sort of support it.
Yeah, well, the foundation follows the Australian Sports Foundation guidelines, which is, you know, the development facilities, this type of thing, and it really thrives on donations. The Friends of Gordon really started out. We were just a group who decided that we'd stick together. We'd build a, for lack of a better word, we became a punters club.
Yeah.
You know, which was, and we grew, and we're 83 odd members, and we build a sum of money each year, and we go to the club and we say, how can we help you? And we become, you know, we look at things. We're very happy. We don't want to give money to pay players, but we will give money to support players in need. So when the player is injured, they can't pay their rent, we'll help out with rent. We'll help out with university. So whilst the club has the UTS scholarship arrangement, if there's a player out there that wants to go to Sydney Uni, for example, we might we will consider helping out on that basis. We help with some equipment. And, you know, this might sound quirky, but every year we put on a first grade dinner for the club, for the first grade squad coaches and what have you. And we teach them the traditions, what it means that they're custodians of the Gordon legacy and so forth. The last dinner we had, which is only a month or so ago, we had over 5,000 club games in the room.
Yeah.
From the Friends of Gordon, we had about 40 fogs, plus all the first grade squad and what have you. Willie Jeffcott gave a wonderful speech about, you know, his journey as a Gordon player, and how, you know, when the boys run out to on the field, they're following the footsteps of wonderful people and all this type of thing. Mike Spaulding, who played 400 games, has just done a video on it. If you can see it on the club website. And what we're trying to build is character development, you know, that type of thing. And if we can help out in a way that is consistent with those principles, we will do so.
Yeah, and I mean, it's amazing when you walk into an environment. And look, I've played at a bunch of different clubs in my time, but it is amazing when you walk into a club environment where there is a recognized history, a celebration of it, a real identity. I think that's something that some clubs struggle to do. And again, especially when a club is losing, it is very hard to establish an identity, because at the moment, you know, in that moment, it's really hard to raise people's hopes and perceptions. I suppose, you know, this is the sort of thing you guys have sort of been trying to do. And it's gotten to your point now where you're one of the, you know, top clubs in Sydney. What do you think the future is for sort of clubs like Gordon, and perhaps more broadly the competition? Where do you think the next sort of chapter goes? Because rugby does feel like Australian rugby broadly in 2021 is starting to kind of try and recalibrate and get from the national level to even the club and the amateur levels. And certainly there's a lot of interest now at, you know, trying to raise the profile of the semi-professional levels to support teams like the Waratahs.
Can I answer that with a story? Because it's interesting. I went to North Sydney Tech and North Sydney Boys, and both those schools, especially North Sydney Boys, well, no, both schools, rich traditions in sporting backgrounds. North Sydney Tech sadly closed. That's why we moved up to North Sydney High. But, you know, Alan Border, alumni of North Sydney High, Ian Craig, some great rugby players, John Treloar, the famous Olympian. This name. But 2 years ago, I was asked to go along and speak to the Year 12 leadership group for the following year. And I went down and had a look at the honour board and the sporting honour board, and it stops. And what it struck me was, you know, it's all about, for North Sydney High, the Waratah Shield, all this type of thing, they no longer play rugby. Mm. All the state schools that were once good rugby and cricket and other sport nurseries no longer play it, because unless you have a teacher who is heavily, as I understand it, who is heavily interested in it, you don't get a program off the ground. So we're now becoming very reliant as a code on the private schools who still play rugby and sports highs. Mm. I think that dynamic has to change. I think that's, you know, rugby rugby specifically is a great character building sport. Yes, it's a collision sport, but, you know, with the right environments and all the support that goes in the protocols now, and with enthusiasm, can balance itself well in the world of academia, which is what the big school. Manly High don't play rugby. They produce some of the great rugby players.
Yeah.
You know, Sydney High, you know, all these things. How do we go back and get rugby back in? Because you've got your junior bases are growing. You know, the junior rugby, the numbers are growing. Women's rugby is growing. It's wonderful. How do we tap into that? Because they still go to, they're going to school. It shouldn't be just left to the junior clubs to develop that. So I'd be looking, for my two bob's worth, is what could we do? There's a lot of people out there that have through the Department of Education and what have you, would have a view, probably not consistent with mine, but at least that would seem like an opportunity, because it's you growing up creates the fire, the desire to play the sport as you get older.
Yeah.
The other one would be that rugby clubs are 9 times out of 10, you're dependent on boards, and it's who can I get on the board? They change frequently. And with that change, it's like any other club, sometimes their priorities change. You need a foundation underneath that has an enduring 3-year plan or 5-year plan that enables that the board adjusts as you go along. I mean, that's a model of successful companies.
Yep.
Why couldn't the boards actually are companies, not just rugby clubs or sporting clubs, because they're taking income, that, you know, they're doing a lot of things. And how do you make that a sustainable model? Everybody's well-intended, everybody. So can we help out by helping people move into those clubs to help them get going? Now, you might need the support of some seed funding and what have you. You can't always make it self-funding, but I think it's a journey it's a journey worth taking if it can be done correctly.
Do you think that the Shoot Shield competition could become a bigger, dare I say it, professional competition that that sits underneath something like Shoot Shield? Because at the moment, I think there's this sort of, it does appear to be, you know, some clubs can sort of afford to pay a coach or players, others can't, and you know, there is this sort of imbalance across it. But if sort of tomorrow the Rugby Australia or you know, a commercial sponsor was to come in and try and, you know, professionalise it across the top, do you think that would change it for the better or even or the worse?
That's a very, very good question. I don't think any club has the capacity to be able to pay a full-time 23 squad. That's crazy. Look, if I would hazard to say that the two most important people, if you've got a good, solid, strong board that understands, you know, the business side of things, but then the two most important people in your club are your general manager and your head coach.
Yep.
How can, if you've got 12 clubs, how can you contribute to ensuring that you have 12 strong general managers, 12 strong head coaches, or whatever the number is, and gives them the security? A club coach who's earning, there's different numbers that you hear, but you know, most of them have got, if not all, apart from a couple, all have full-time jobs. It's hard for them to get out and about and do the recruiting and the networking and the developing and the working with the juniors and, you know, the work in the high schools. They should be, in some respect, head coach development. You know, they're the focal point for your community. And your general manager is a very powerful. There's some great general managers out there. Some do it, voluntarily. Some are paid, and they're just wonderful servants of their clubs.
Mm.
Probably didn't answer the question. What do I think of Shoot Shield? I think Shoot Shield should be a premier rugby competition in an amateur way. I think where you start to look at the semi-professional, I'm a fan of the NRC.
Yeah.
I was involved with the North Harbour Rays. Where it fell down was that we were asking young players to give up 7 or 8 weeks of their time and not be paid for it or compensated for it.
Mm.
And so the NRC, like the ITM Cup and Vincent, that's where, if you're going to make it to the professional level, you need to show that you can perform at that next level, which is the stepping stone. The question is, how do you build the levels of support around it? And it's a good question, but it can be done if everybody buys in. Brad Thorne was coach of Queensland Country, and he said, and Queensland, when the NRC came in, said, we're having two teams. We're having Brisbane City. We're having Queensland Country. They're going to be Queensland players. And Queensland Rugby was right behind them. WA did the same. New South Wales, we had this four teams that started off. But North Harbour Rays were four clubs, you know, Warringah, Norths, Gordon and Manly. We came together, we self-funded it with the wonderful support of Macquarie University, and we created something.
Mm.
And sadly, it didn't go through. But the quality of, I think they tried to change a few of the rules around, but the players who played in it stepped up. Some went on to, you know, your Michael Wells is now in the Wallaby squad. He came through that pathway. There were players that went on, and I'm going to do them disservice by not naming them, it was good rugby. The problem with it was that they tried to manufacture it with these 7-point, you know, the scoring system. So a blowout of 50 something or other wasn't, in reality, the scores were a lot closer. It was just the points made it seem, they tried to make the game faster.
Yeah,
and the players will even tell you it was a faster game. It was a more physical game, and somebody told me, I think it was Sterling Mortlock. I asked him. I said, "What did you think of the NRC?" And he made a very interesting point. He said, "I've seen players step up who really look like they should, they have an opportunity to earn a contract, and I've seen players who are coming off contract have still not learnt the lessons that they should, you know." To have, and that's really the defining point, isn't it? To have that competition level, to play with the different people, to come together. That's where I think the professional, where you step into that professional level. The other thing that sort of murked it around a little bit was coaches took players. When we kicked it off, we said you could only play with four clubs to create the identity, unless there was a position of critical need that we couldn't fill within the four clubs. Other clubs were just taking people from here, there, wherever, and it potentially seemed to be a bit of a recruiting drive for the club at a later point.
Right.
Now, if you take aside whether that's a right or wrong, but if you take that aside, step back and say, what could I do? We know we need a third tier. How do we make that third tier right, where everybody's on the same page? And clubs, the Super Rugby clubs, to whom employ their players, we wanted one Manly player who was playing third grade at Box Hill and just creaming them. We said we would like him if it's possible. No, we can't release him because he's contracted to us and he's probably going to have to need him. And we thought, he can't go from third grade Box Hill, if that was the right club, and I apologise if it wasn't, to then play Super Rugby, can he?
No.
Doesn't work.
And then I think that's what has certainly been, I think, you know, completely revealed this year. When you look at the Waratahs, and you know, obviously they've had some bad luck with injuries. They've lost players like Michael Hooper for sort of, you know, their sabbaticals, and you know, it's coming out now that they have made a profit, but that, you know, perhaps they should have put that money into maybe more recruiting. But certainly, you know, there were a lot of young guys that had to step up this year, and you know, whether or not they'd had the ability to, I suppose, as Sterling said, have a look at them through another type of competition, just to see, you know, where are their failings, you know, because to be good at Shoot Shield is one thing, but then to step up and have to replicate that success in an environment like Super Rugby, especially when you're playing the Kiwi teams at the moment, it's a lot of pressure, and it's a lot to ask of a young player.
And how does a player that spends a lot of time training, not a lot of game time, all of a sudden step up to play? It must be the player is willing, the body, I don't know if the body or mind would be willing, you know. It seems like such a tough ask. This is where I think the Shoot Shield needs players who are not playing you know, in the day, in the Shoot Shield squad, should be allowed to go back to their club. There should be, I don't like quota systems. I don't like anything. I just don't think that works. There'll always be strong clubs. Remember St. George in the rugby league, 12 years in a row, and everybody thought they were the kings of, you know, and then you had Western Suburbs. But the pendulum swings. You've got to be patient with the pendulum, because, you know, over time, it's about building the fellowship from that. So your juniors are very important. But when they get to that critical point of 18, 19, 20, they can go different ways. We've got to encourage them into the rugby system by making it available and for them to come through. I have no expertise in being able to give you know, an insight into Penrith, other than to say that it's one of those clubs where you look at and you say, everybody's pitching in hard. There is still the opportunity there. Why was it strong at one point? Remember, it was Peter Bessling was out there, and they were a reasonably strong club, and this might be the 90s or something. There's still the opportunity there. This is really a rhetorical question, and probably, you know, I'll be taking the task over it, but sometimes you need outside people looking in to ask the questions, then the people who are so close to it that are trying to find the answers. And that's why in our experience, we went outside our bubble to get the answers.
Mate, historically, Australia the Wallabies did the same thing. When you go back into the 1970s, you know, we went to Wales and we sought advice from the Welsh, and Queensland were one of the first provinces to, you know, I don't want to give you a history lesson, you probably know this, but it just seems relative that, you know, you get to a point where you're sort of looking for answers, and if you can't get them, then you know, the answer is not to keep doing more of the same. I think, you know, we tend to be doing sometimes in rugby is we sort of want to keep hoping that what worked in the past will one day work again when the stars align. And sometimes life doesn't work that way. You actually have to do something quite, you know, monumental to shift things around. I guess sort of look one, you know, I'll probably sort of wrap it up soon, but I do want to sort of mention, you mentioned before, Gordon recruiting Darren Coleman, and of course his success speaks for itself. How many coaches, and he was a fully professional coach now with the LA Giltinis, and as of today, it's just been reported that the Waratahs have made him an offer, hasn't sort of accepted the offer. There are obviously some terms around the length of that contract that are still to be agreed upon. But how many coaches like Darren Coleman, who have been around for a while, coached a lot of different clubs, and you know, are a fully professionally paid coach, how many of them do you think are floating around in somewhere like Sydney?
That's a really good question, because you see, well, how many of them have had to float offshore to continue their journeys, and how many of them have been successful in? How many Australian coaches would there be in the UK now? There'd be a few at the club level in Japan. So at one level, we haven't created a market that encourages them to stay, to be able to ply their trade, to bring to do their thing. On the other hand, you know, we're not a big enough market to be able to afford whatever it is they get paid or they need to get paid. But I take you've got to take a risk. I like the Tim Sampson, who is the Western Force coach. His dad, Bob Sampson, is a Gordon legend. And, you know, Tim's one of those coaches who appears to think outside the square on some stuff. You like coaches like that. I think you've got to be able to encourage those to come through, and we've got to find a way to keep them in the system in Australia, because they have the connections, and they also have I'm not quite sure if I agree necessarily that you have to be an Australian to be an Australian coach. What you have to do is have the connection to people and the community, so that they look up to you as much as you look to them.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Well, it does. And I mean, where I look at where coaches have done well in this country, and you know, and I think this still stands today, and maybe this is what we'll see with guys like Darren if he takes the offer of being the Waratahs head coach, is that players, when we look at players that come through pathways, and we can sometimes pinpoint what's worked in terms of them, playing at a representative level, then at a certain club where they were successful, and then they've been able to replicate that. And I feel like the same is for coaches. Some of the best coaches are the ones that have also come through that coaching pathway. And, you know, in the past where we've recruited, coaches, or where coaches have come from overseas, not because they're a bad coach, but because they are having to presumably straight away, there's an expectation that they bring success with them. And if they haven't got a rapport with the players, if they haven't got an understanding of the environment, and they don't have any history with all the clubs and the systems underneath that have contribute to, you know, what makes the Waratahs, it's very hard for them to adapt and quickly hit the ground running. And I can only assume that's partly why guys like Rob Penny have struggled, and perhaps even going back, the Wallabies coaches Robbie Deans, you know, who at that point in time was one of the best coaches in the world. So I do hope that with someone like Dave Rennie now as head coach of the Wallabies, all those sorts of hurdles are recognised even by him and the people around them. And they're trying to, you know, he's got to school up very quickly who all these players are, understand them, understand their strengths and weaknesses. Whereas a Brad Thorne has had 3 or 4 years getting to know his players intimately, even from when he was coaching the NRC. And so You know, that to me makes a huge amount of difference. And I'm not sure if we've recognized that, and we've put a lot of effort into developing our players and not so much in recognizing what makes the best environment for our coaches to thrive.
I would love to see, you know, coaches be given a pathway. Again, you go back to your corporate world. There's nothing different in the corporate world. You find people in your organization with high potential or with the potential to do things, and you help them through with pathways. And whilst loyalty to a large extent is something that, you know, to loyalty to one organization is not the same as it was, you know, 20 years ago, there's still loyalty to what you're trying to achieve and what you set out to achieve. And if you treat the people, you know, with dignity and respect and all those sorts of things, they will stay with you. But the pathway is very important. Now, the pathway might not always be clear, and you have to take some side steps along the way, but the end goal is still there. If I do these things and I understand what I've got to do, and I would, for example, if you just go back to Darren, as much as this seems counterintuitive, but if you think about it, I think you move your coaches around in your shoot shield clubs to some extent every 2 or 3 years. Different voices, different things. But these are coaches who you identify as potentially being your next Waratahs coach or your next whatever. So they've got a set of experiences beyond. So you just don't always come through the one club, one funnel system. Maybe a bit left field, and it'll probably come up with, you know, there'll be people say, oh, he's mad. But I just believe in giving people a whole set of experiences outside their comfort zones that shows and demonstrates that they can move. I've been impressed with Billy Melrose at Gordon this year. He's different to Darren. He's, you know, he's got some interesting ideas and stuff. But when you talk to him, you kind of get it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And I think that's important.
And from a club perspective, and, you know, how much awareness do you think there is around giving coaches a time to make an impact? I think certainly in the professional environment, it seems as though, you know, almost two seasons is sometimes a bit of a limit if a team's not performing. But, you know, for sort of clubs in a more sort of amateur setting, do you think that there is a bit more of a leniency to let them come in and try to sort of, you know, make the changes and make the improvements that they've set out to do from the beginning of their tenure?
I would hope so. I think there's a, you know, 2 to 3 years seems to be a, you know, your first year is your building year or transition year from your previous, you know. You've got Warringah is a really interesting, if you look at Warringah 2017 or 16, 17, 18, they, you know, climbed the hill, won the premiership, have sort of plateaued, but in that time they've lost Dave Feltshire, Sammy Ward, Hamish Angus, Harry Jones, some of the Boyd Killingworth and what have you. So they're rebuilding again. Norths have done the same. All clubs go through it. And, you know, if you chop change your coaches, then your transition becomes bumpy. So how do you make sure that you give your coach will be confident, like a player will be confident if you give them the support and the time to do what they need. Now, they have to demonstrate that they're hitting their targets and what have you, but I don't think you can be impatient unless it's an absolute, you know, bun fight and it just doesn't work.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Hopefully, if Darren does come on board, you hope that they're going to give him a bit of time, because, yeah, it certainly seemed like poor old Rob Penny had a tough task in the last 2 years. And, you know, I don't think I'm sort of the opinion that while I believe coaches are very influential, there's so many other factors that often are overlooked in terms of what actually makes success as a club, but even on the field. But anyway, I suppose, look, Pete, I really do appreciate it. It's been very interesting and very refreshing. Typically you're just there every Saturday. Obviously there's a lockdown in Sydney, so the next week or two is going to be at home watching whatever rugby's on the telly.
Yeah.
But you're typically down at the game most weeks, sort of manning the Fogs tent and
we have a bit of a call to arms, you know. I live in Collaroy, so occasionally I'll wander down to watch the Rats play. So if Gordon were playing, say Southern Districts, I might go down to Southern Districts. But if the Rats were playing, say North, I might wander down and have a look. As much as I'm a Gordon person, I love my club rugby. I love watching young kids being given the opportunity. I like watching the third grade, the fourth grade. Colts is always a revelation, watching good rugby. So for me, that you can be wedded to one club and proud to be a member of one club, but it's club rugby is the jewel.
Yeah, and I think that is, that is for me one of the kind of conundrums that rugby in this country has to sort of deal with is, everyone can get behind the Wallabies. I think that's, certainly when they're successful, even non-rugby supporters. Everyone's attached in some way to their club or maybe even their school for a period of time. It's that bit in the middle, where we then have to try to figure out how can you translate that interest into either the Super Rugby franchise or an NRC type tournament, because that's an area where we've fell down. And in the lean years and the tough times, for me, the idea that New South Wales Waratahs can't get more than 5,000 people to a game, and I'm not a Waratah supporter, but that is just, it fills me with horror, because that to me suggests that, there's a massive, it's a massive failing in our ability to create the game as good as it can. So as I said, there's something in the middle that needs to be, and I just don't feel like it has been properly articulated for a number of reasons, but also the solution hasn't been found because it is so complex and it is very hard to piece all these moving parts together.
And success is fickle too. I mean, the Sydney is a hard market, as you too. The Waratahs is really they need big crowds to sustain their financial model, and they need to be seem to be on the front foot. They seem to have been on the back foot for a period of time. Change of board, change of chairman might just give them that sort of that refreshment that they need, and then hopefully some fresh ideas coming in would be very helpful. I think they're rebuilding, so we just have to be patient with them. They will be successful in the future. It's just a question of time, having the right person as a coach or people in place. And, by and large, coaches like to have it appears to me they like to have the say on who their roster is, and yet that's probably not always been the case with some clubs. So I inherit a roster that I really not quite sure I can deal with. Well, that's an interesting question in itself.
Well, it'll be
successful. We will be successful. Rugby will be successful.
Yeah. Well, that's it. And I think it'll be really interesting. It'll be a really interesting period to watch. And certainly if Darren Coleman comes in and, the people around him and the new players, everyone loves to come back. So hopefully happens soon. All right, Peter. Well, look, I appreciate it once again, and all the best in your endeavours with Gordon, and I hope Gordon can perhaps make finals this year and have an opportunity to defend their title.
Good on you. Take care. All right.
Cheers, mate. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
This is the Gold Digger podcast series, a spin-off from the new feature documentary film, Gold Digger, The Search for Australian Rugby, which will be coming out very soon. Brought to you by me, director and host, Matt Durrant, and sponsored by, still waiting for a sponsor after 20 episodes. Music is by Makeup and Vanity Set, sourced from musicbed.com. Check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/golddiggerrugby. Follow us on Instagram for pretty pictures and Twitter for banal chatter. Till next time, keep on digging.